Before we begin the next chapter, I just want to thank you for all the amazing reviews you've written. They really warm my heart, give me the confidence I need, and help this show find new listeners. So thank you so much. And also thank you to all of my patrons. This show is commercial-free and will remain that way, but you can support my creative process by becoming a patron. Visit sonofelpodcast.com/support. It's only a little bit each month, but it makes a big difference, especially in helping me believe in myself. I love telling this story and appreciate you enabling me to keep telling it. So thank you, and enjoy the show. You're listening to Book 2 of Superman, Son of El. He is more than a story. He is more than a comic book superhero. He is more than a symbol of hope. He represents our greatest aspirations. He is everything we think we can be. And yet, even with all the strength and all the power in all of the world, he may not be able to meet his greatest challenges and redeem his family's legacy, for he is the Son of El. Chapter 17, Ask the Right Question. Clark's encounter with a stranger outside of Linda's preschool didn't sit right with him. By itself, having met a man with no discernible facial features, no mouth, nose, eyes, or brows of which to speak of, was disquieting. The man's message was equally vague. The note simply listed two names, Will Magnus and Miles Calder. Clark looked them up and found that Calder studied under Magnus. They both worked in robotics and seemed to be upstanding scientists. There was little else to learn. What bothered Clark most was this man's choice of timing, appearing in the morning just after Clark had dropped off Linda for her first day of preschool. Broaching the topic of this mysterious figure with the rest of the family felt tenuous, but despite his inhibitions, he brought it up after dinner. It was more challenging to explain than Clark expected. Lana tried to clarify what he was saying.
So, he didn't have a face?
No, that's not it. It's just that I couldn't make out his face. It was there, but I just don't know how to describe it.
Pete pushed his plate aside as though to clear up some space for thinking.
Would you say he had a big nose or a little nose?
Both or neither. I couldn't say, but it's beside the point. I just want everyone to be aware that he's a bit odd and, well, though I don't think he means any harm, I would rather be safe than sorry.
Martha had a suggestion as she served herself a second helping.
Perhaps we ought to tell Linda's teacher, too.
Despite the family's precautions, the faceless man in the trench coat calling himself The Question did not come around further and faded from concern. For the twins' 9th birthday, they hosted a party that had nearly half of Smallville's elementary 4th grade. While the kids ran through the trails on a scavenger hunt, the parents mingled. Clark's books were a recurring point of interest, especially his most recent one, Superman Can't Save Us. One father in particular, Carl, wouldn't let the subject rest.
No, but really, what do you think about Superman? At this point, he's just holding us back, right?
I didn't say that. Well, yeah, sure, but you would if you could, right? I know how things work. They don't let you say how it is.
I said exactly what I meant to say. His hints weren't taken, and Clark was glad to escape Carl's company when it was time for the birthday cake. Moments like these, encountering overly enthusiastic readers, were becoming a pattern. At the boys' soccer matches, certain parents made sure to sit alongside Clark, offering their opinions on his book and who they thought was to blame. There was no place Clark could escape the attention. That year, Joey took up the clarinet. His music teacher made it clear that she was a fan, leaving Clark's book on the coffee table whenever Clark brought Joey to his lessons. After the third visit, Clark realized he ought to offer to sign the book. While Joey was learning an instrument, Jerry joined their school's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. His theater teacher was sure to catch Clark's ear whenever he saw him, praising Jerry's acting skills. Clark was proud of his son, though it felt a bit awkward, as Carl, from the birthday party, also had a kid in the play, and Clark hoped to excuse himself before Carl could strike up a conversation. It frustrated Clark to no end to hear someone talk about his book and so bluntly miss every one of his points. Carl not only missed them while he was reading the book, he refused to hear them in person. And it wasn't just Carl by any stretch. Clark was dreading the Harvest Ball and all the attention he would receive. Though to his welcome surprise, no one at the event said a thing to him about his book. Afterward, Pete confessed, everyone who attended was handed a little card as they entered that simply read, "Don't talk to him about his book." It was a relief, though the break did not last long. After Joey's music recital, while the parents mingled, Clark found himself cornered by a passionate reader with visions of grandeur. They described themselves going to these countries in Clark's book and beginning an eco-terrorism campaign because Superman refused to.
"Do you hear what I'm saying? The planks of this boat need to take control of the ship. Those people down there could use some leadership. They just need the guidance."
Clark looked this man in the eye and took a long, deep breath before putting it simply.
"I've met a lot of those people, and they're doing their best in a hard situation, just like the rest of us. But we all kind of have to tend to ourselves to help one another. You and I both have kids, and they both played their instruments pretty darn well tonight. Just keep providing your little girl a space to grow and be her best self, and that's enough."
The man stared at Clark with his mouth slightly agape. After a beat, he nodded, thanked Clark, and fetched his daughter to head home. Clark wondered if a strategy like this could get through to Carl. A couple of weeks later, as Clark and the family arrived for the opening night of Jerome's play, he planned to try this approach if he found himself confronted. Martha and Drew went to save everyone a seat, while Clark and Lana took Joey and Linda to get treats at the bake sale in the lobby. Clark fell back to let the children pick for themselves when a hand gripped his shoulder. He took a breath, readying himself to talk to Carl, but turned to find himself face to face with barely any face at all. It was the question.
"Do you still have my card?"
Clark nodded. The question scanned the crowded room.
"Good. Take this."
Careful not to be noticed, and yet seemingly obvious to Clark, the question handed him another slip of paper. Clark read the scribbled words, and again it was just two names, Linda Holland and Karen Faulkner. Clark tried to direct the exchange.
"And who are they? Two more scientists?"
"If you connect the dots, you'll know by tomorrow."
As he said this, the question popped the collar on his trench coat, turned, and walked away. When Clark and the family returned to their seats with their snacks, Lana leaned in close to ask Clark,
"Who was that man talking to you? I wasn't able to get a good look at him."
"That was the guy I was talking about months ago. The question."
Lana gasped.
"That's what you meant. I couldn't quite make out his face even while looking right at him. What did he want?"
"He gave me another slip of paper."
"Anything interesting?"
"Just two more names."
"Ooh, I love a good mystery."
Their conversation trailed off into whispers as the lights dimmed and the topic was set aside. After the play, Clark did a little digging into the two names that the question had provided him. They were scientists, as Clark suspected. Olson was a botanist, and Faulkner was a geneticist. The two of them had begun working with each other a couple of years ago, exploring the potential of photosynthesis in animals. They had no association with the two robotics engineers from the previous note. Nothing about them stood out to Clark. Whatever connections the question thought he would make weren't as clear as he implied. The next day came and went, and Clark heard nothing from the mysterious fellow. Clark considered calling the number on the question's business card, but instead decided to first check in with Batman. It was early evening when he arrived at the Batcave. He found Bruce and Damian already suited up as Batman and Robin, though Damian sat at the meeting table listening to headphones while Bruce worked at the computer. When he saw Superman, Damian began to lower his headphones, but Bruce chided him.
"Continue your studies."
This was all the prompt the boy needed, resuming his listening and averting his eyes from their radiant guest.
"Welcome back. What brings you this time?"
"Do you know anything about a mysterious man without a face calling himself the question?"
"So, even you can't see his face. Fascinating."
"Have you met him?"
"No, but Gotham PD has a history with him. His real name is Victor Sage. Compared to the mentally ill people I have to deal with, Sage is harmless. He excels at research and slipping in where he shouldn't be, but he lacks the mental cohesion to put it all together. At best, I would call him a conspiracy theorist,
I guess that's a relief. Twice now he's found me to hand me a note. Both times while I was with my kids.
Sage is following you.
I don't think so. These appearances were months apart.
Does he know you're Superman?
Not at all. He read my book and is trying to recruit me onto his mission.
Good luck. And be careful when you transform into Superman. Sage is hard to spot in a crowd, and sometimes even harder to see by himself.
Good thinking. That hadn't crossed my mind.
On second thought, if Sage might be around, it's a bad idea for Bruce Wayne to vacation at Clark Kent's home. We better postpone our trip this year.
That's months from now.
And you saw him months ago. It's better to play it safe around Sage. I'm disappointed too. Your boys are a good influence on Damian.
They're good boys.
And they have good role models.
Well, it takes a village to raise a baby, and we're pretty lucky to have the village we've got.
Bruce gave Clark a slow, affirming nod. I appreciate being included in that number.
Of course you're included, Bruce. You and I are just two more babies in this village.
Bruce glanced at Clark a moment out of the corner of his eye, bemused. You certainly are Martha's son.
Too bad you won't get a visitor this summer.
There's no point in trying to persuade me on this. Clark was disappointed, but he understood. Victor Sage wasn't a direct threat, but his investigation could mean trouble for Bruce if his connection to Clark Kent was discovered. There were too many follow-up questions that would be difficult to untangle should their friendship become public. Unfortunately, this was the beginning of a long stretch without any visits from the Waynes. Not long after Linda's fourth birthday in the spring, Clark suggested to Lana that perhaps Victor Sage snooping around might be enough reason to not go camping that year. She conceded it was for the best, but like the rest of the family, she was a bit crestfallen to hear it. Clark was as well, but he saw the opportunity this offered. He needed more time in his days to enact his plan to foster protections for mill workers. With a little shape-shifting, he could get inside these mills and see how they performed when they didn't think Superman was watching. Transforming wasn't so difficult for Clark when he took appearances of someone similar to his own size and form. As expected, once inside the mills, he found they were all running under unsafe conditions. Infiltrating break rooms, Clark talked to workers, identifying who might help him form a union. This was a slow process that Clark could only initiate in a few mills at a time. He needed experience inside to form a long-term plan. At the secret meetings he organized, in disguise as a local worker he invented, Clark suggested to them that they unionize. He told them that he had connections to Superman and could ask for his protection. Clark knew these people were potentially in danger by organizing their fellow workers. Meanwhile, at the sustainability summits he led, Superman started presenting guidelines for workers' rights, even suggesting that he would plant fewer trees in the countries that failed to meet his guidelines. It was a stance celebrated by workers, yet made Superman increasingly less popular in the views of the companies directly profiting from his permaculture efforts. At their behest, politicians in many of these countries began introducing bills to slow down the unionizing process. Some were going so far as to create laws for businesses to take recourse against Superman for damaging their equipment. There had only been a few instances of this, but they were emphasized as though it was a constant threat. Lois Lane offered her perspective when she came to visit Kent Farm for the first time since Clark and Lana's wedding.
You could take care of two birds with one stone if you could just interview Superman already. I'm sure Jean would help again if you asked. Superman could get a chance to have his perspective told, and Clark Kent would get a boost in his book sales. Everyone wins.
At the rate things are going, that sounds like a no-win scenario.
Okay, but how about the talk show circuit? This news Superman is stirring up about workers' rights is bringing a new surge of attention to your book.
I wish it wouldn't. This book's had a way of bringing me a lot of unwanted attention.
Oh, shush. Nonsense. You're Superman. You're constantly under public scrutiny.
Well, duh. But being Clark Kent has usually been a good break from all that. These days, I'm attracting some of the oddest tools in the tool shed, if you know what I mean.
I like to call it broad appeal. You were bound to get noticed by some people struggling with reality.
Lois's stay was mostly spent gossiping with Lana and Martha. They spent the day helping Martha with her quilting project. Lana had been understudying with Martha, but Lois mostly handed them pins and scissors to be helpful. Lois played with the kids, paying special attention to Linda.
Here she is, Danvers Jr.
Linda loved the attention, basking in it.
Lois, in contrast, found herself blushing as the little girl brought her flowers throughout the day. Little of her attention was left for the twins, but they were sure to compete for it when it was available. Before she left, she asked Clark one more time.
So, what do you say? You, me, Superman, and an international platform to conduct an interview. How about it?
I'll pass. Thanks.
Lois held up one finger, jabbing it in Clark's direction.
But you'll do the talk shows, right?
Yeah, sure. I'll do some talk shows.
Clark found this concession easy enough, though he was a bit bothered to see the lengths these shows had to go through to weed out the fanatics from the studio audience. On the occasion that one of them slipped through and got in, they often stood up and started shouting until they were escorted from the building. These outbursts came in three general types: those for Superman, those against Superman, and some hybrid third group, for Superman vicariously, but mostly for their fellow mankind. Their outbursts embarrassed Clark to no end, even feeling shame for his sense of relief when they were finally removed by security. Backstage, before filming one of these talk shows, Clark left his dressing room to find himself, again, face to face with the man with no face. It was Victor Sage, the Question. Sage held his own chin, one arm crossed.
You've been busy. I hope your newfound fame isn't preventing you from being a journalist in pursuit of truth.
Yeah, well, it all comes with the job.
Fair enough.
Sage looked up and down the hall.
We have little time. This is no place to talk. Take this.
Once again, Sage handed Clark a bit of folded paper with just two names written on it. Carter Nichols and Percival Sutter. Clark looked up from the paper.
I honestly don't know what you're trying to tell me.
Sage started to walk away as he spoke.
Trust me. It all comes together tomorrow.
Again, like the last time he saw Victor Sage, nothing happened the next day. However, Clark did use the time to learn what he could about Nichols and Sutter. Like the other names provided by Victor Sage, they were scientists, both studying the brain and its perception of time. Their work sounded fascinating. Sutter was attempting to alter the speed with which the mind perceived time, and Nichols was developing technology for retrieving memories. Yet as before, these men had no clear relation to the other scientists. Clark saw no nefarious plans at play. Whatever grand conspiracy Sage was convinced of was all very vague. Clark's home life had enough to worry about. Soccer season had begun again, and Joseph and Jerome were garnering quite a reputation for their agility on the field. Coaches from the older kids' teams frequently came over to watch them play. The novelty of Clark's books had worn off in Smallville, and he was grateful to no longer be receiving so much attention at his son's events. Jerome came home from school one day, upset to report there were fewer parts for younger actors in the school's play that year. He expected a bit part at best. Joseph, on the other hand, was becoming less satisfied with his clarinet. But not for a lack of interest. He was trying to convince Clark and Lana that what the family needed was a piano. He managed to convince Linda to join his chorus, and the two of them sang the praises of having one. Joey attempted to explain the many benefits.
It's not just for me either.
Linda joined in.
Joey's gonna play me songs to dance to.
Joseph bounced on the balls of his feet.
And maybe Jerry will learn to play. And you can learn to play it, Ma.
Jerry heard this and began campaigning for a drum set. Unfortunately, in Joey's eyes, Jerry was only lessening the chances for a piano. Clark believed they could both be possible, but said nothing. This idea, like his union organizing, was a secret he kept to himself. Fostering workers' unions was a fine balance for Clark. While in disguise, he put the union leaders, with whom he organized, in contact with Superman. Once this was accomplished, his alias identity as a worker would be called away for some made-up distant medical emergency. It was a strange practice, but it proved effective. When these organizers did find themselves in danger of union busters, they had Superman checking in on them within minutes. This process was bolstering strong unions and instilled hesitation in the factories wanting to disband them. In turn, it afforded Clark more time to help with the Harvest Ball than he had had in years. He and Lana took on the brunt of the planning process, just as they had used to before having kids. While setting up, Lana had to admit,
"They've broken me down, Clark. At this point, I need to learn to play the piano."
I don't blame you.
They make a hard pitch and it's heart-melting. I think we should surprise them with one this Christmas.
Oh, I like that plan.
How about this? For the holiday, we all head up to the Crystal Palace for the Aurora Borealis, and then we surprise them when we get home.
Oh, that sounds magical. Did you just come up with that?
No, I've been doing some planning. I looked up the Northern Lights forecast, and we're in for a good show that week.
I love it. But does this mean we're getting Jerry a drum set?
If he truly wants to learn, I'm not saying no.
Pete, Drew, and Martha all declined the invitation. They had plans for a big caroling event at the Smallville Community Center, but the kids were ecstatic to go to the North Pole for Christmas. They had never seen the Fortress of Solitude before and marveled at the sight of its glistening walls. Like a kaleidoscope, it refracted the colors of the Aurora Borealis dancing above them. It was a family camping trip like no other as they cuddled in the pile of blankets and pillows in the middle of the padded circular room. That far to the north, the sun did not rise that morning, making it easy to sleep in. Nonetheless, despite the dark, the kids were eager to explore. While they and Lana discovered the Martian atrium, Clark dashed off, planning to move the piano into the house, set up the drum kit, and be back before the kids realized he was gone. His enthusiasm was slightly shaken when he came home to discover a small note on the door. Clark recognized the handwriting. It simply read, "Pay attention tomorrow." This distraction slowed Clark down enough that the kids did indeed notice his absence, though it did not diminish their delight to discover their surprise. The holidays were especially loud that year and almost melodic at times, mostly thanks to Joseph. If the kids were in a band, their sound had only slightly refined as winter melted away and Linda's fifth birthday came around. With spring came the discussion of a family camping trip. Martha was voting to go, almost insisting. Lana agreed.
"We can't live our lives around whether Victor Sage wants to give you a scribbled little piece of paper. I say we go. As far as we can tell, he's not following us. Let's not miss another beautiful summer."
Her speech convinced Clark. Better yet, it inspired him to visit Gotham and invite Bruce and Damian to come back for a visit. He found Damian by himself, suiting up in the Batcave. Damian looked up, having noticed the light of Superman's radiance. He answered Clark's question before Clark could ask it.
"He's upstairs. He'll be down in a moment."
"Thanks, Damian. How are you doing?" The 13-year-old puzzled his brow.
"I'm improving. That is the best we can hope for."
"I hear that. It's a worthy goal."
"Superman, can I ask you a question?"
"Sure, go ahead."
"You have the ability, the power. Why don't you seize control?"
"Control? Control of what?"
"You could bend this world to your will. Why don't you, Superman?"
"Well, that's not the kind of world I want to live in. But it's a good question, and maybe I can answer it better for you one day. And you can just call me Clark."
Damian gave Clark a hard stare.
"Are you sure?"
"Yeah, as long as we're among family, sure, of course."
Damian nodded.
"Thank you."
"No problem."
Bruce entered, wearing his supersuit without the cape and cowl. "I'm surprised to see you here. You didn't set off a single sensor. Very impressive."
"I'm hoping I can convince you to visit this year. I can speak for the whole family when I say we would love to see you both."
"When was the last time you heard from Sage?"
A few months ago."
"No can do. You're still too hot a topic. Sorry, Clark." Regardless of his disappointment, Clark felt bad for Damian, having observed the boy's posture perk up and be let down by the proposal. Bruce's paranoia proved to be justified when Clark and the family returned home from their camping trip to discover another of Sage's notes on the door of the house. This one read, "Everything will make sense tomorrow." It was a little unnerving, but Clark couldn't help but chuckle. This man was clearly a bit off in the head. Despite Victor Sage's constant warnings, nothing ever happened the next day. Clark figured if Sage kept these predictions up, he was sure to be correct eventually. It was a thought worth a laugh, but Clark couldn't shake the sense that Sage could be waiting for him around every corner. The morning he dropped off Linda for her first day in kindergarten, he scanned the street repeatedly, expecting the faceless man to emerge at any moment.
Clark had to remind himself that even if Sage showed up, the man did little harm by scrawling his notes and giving them to a reporter. Usually, as a reporter, being reached out to by an informant, Clark would have called back by now. But in Victor Sage's case, it felt different. The man had introduced himself far too close to Clark's home and family. Sage had repeatedly returned with no effort on Clark's part. Worse yet, Clark didn't even know what he looked like. The question was an appropriate name for the man. This concern followed Clark throughout his day, but only as a background hum of uncertainty. He was meeting Lois that afternoon at the diner across the street from the Daily Planet. It was under new management once more, now calling itself Bebo's, and restored to how Clark remembered it when he was an intern. Lois, rarely shutting off her mind from work, talked business throughout their meal.
The interview would be on the Galaxy News Network, and I typically prefer to have nothing to do with Morgan Edge, so I totally understand if you don't want to do it. But if you do, GNN's audience is a completely different demographic than the Daily Planet reaches.
I don't know. I'm worried this is the demographic that tends to misinterpret my writing. Who's doing the interview?
Cat Grant.
You're kidding me, right? It'll be an hour of softball questions.
Cat can be superficial, I know.
Doesn't she do pedicures with her guests and stuff? And do wine tastings?
Okay, yes, but she's probably the least likely reporter to make this political. You should be excited she read your book.
You think she read it?
She messaged me directly.
This last bit of information did little to relieve Clark's concerns, but Lois made some good points. Finishing their lunch, he was still unsure about doing the interview, but just as it came time to settle their bill, they were interrupted by the cook. Clark recognized him from the diner's kitchen from years ago. He was a burly man with a thick accent.
Well, if it isn't my two favorite customers. And superstars now, I understand. Big deal editor and writer. Where's your photographer friend with the red hair? Anyway, it's good to see you back. I wanted to introduce myself. Bebo, a pleasure to meet you. I used to bust your table when I started out here. Been cooking your meals for years. I just bought the place, so I thought I ought to say hello. Pleasure to meet you, Bebo. I'm Clark Kent. Ah, Mr. Kent, there ain't no need for you to be introducing yourself. You have no idea. Your book changed my life. After reading it, I stepped up, bought this place, and now I'm just being the best plank I can be. Am I right?
Bebo pulled his cooking apron aside, revealing his blue shirt underneath had Superman's emblem on it. The cook grinned with satisfaction.
Superman may not be here to save us, but we all got enough Superman in us to save ourselves, if you know what I mean.
Bebo's sentiment warmed Clark's heart. This was the nudge he needed to persuade him. After they left the diner, he agreed to the interview with Cat Grant. A week later, when Clark arrived for the interview and saw the stage dressings, he instantly regretted his decision. The studio had built a massive wooden deck with an arrangement of wooden furniture on it, all centered around a set of wooden Adirondack chairs. Cat saw the expression on his face. She walked up with a confident strut, in very high heels and some rather revealing business attire.
I know, it's amazing. All of that was sustainably harvested, and all thanks to you.
She had invested in a sustainable timber company and planned to cite Clark's book as the source of her inspiration. Clark hadn't heard of the company she was promoting, but going off of what he knew about the current state of the timber industry, he doubted a company as large as the one she promoted could fulfill these promises. He tried to explain this thinking during the interview, but Kat had an endless set of practice sales points in response.
Honestly, Clark, this is what sets Van Horn apart. They're committed to not just producing beautiful products, but creating a legacy worth remembering. And we can't do that if our forests are being destroyed in the process. Wouldn't you agree?
Clark had little choice but to agree, and found his point impossible to make. He tried his best to instead focus on his book. Thankfully, Kat had actual questions on the topic.
But let me ask you this. What do you think Superman could do to do better?
That's a good question. Though it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Whatever he might try to do to make things better, it seems to have a counter effect as well.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because tonight, we have a surprise guest in the studio. Clark Kent, it is my honor to introduce you to one of the greatest minds of our generation. Former President of the United States, Lex Luthor!
The studio audience burst into a standing ovation. It took at least a minute of applause for Luthor to finish basking in their adoration.
Thank you. It is truly my honor. Thank you. Thank you all so much. You're all too kind. And thank you, Kat, for having me back on the show. It has been too long.
No, Lex. Thank you for coming. It is always amazing to see you. You look marvelous.
As do you. And this must be Clark Kent.
Luther laughed with his usual deep, booming chuckle, though Clark felt it was the most sincere laugh he had heard from Luther yet. Luther sat down in one of the Adirondacks and leaned forward in his seat to shake Clark's hand.
It certainly is true. You really do look like him.
Again, he laughed before continuing, holding the stage like the consummate performer he was.
But wow, what a book. Reading that was something else, Clark Kent. I don't think I've ever read more eloquent words. Your ability to capture just how precisely Superman poses a danger to humanity is profound.
That's not quite what I said. I'm not so sure you interpreted it how I intended it to be heard. Superman, not everything he does is bad. I think most of it is good. The paradox is that, well, the better he does, the less the rest of humanity is motivated to be our best. He can't help us if we can't help ourselves.
No, no, I hear you loud and clear. This is how I've felt since day one. I will admit, perhaps I went about things with a hot head at times, but what has always bothered me most about Superman is how his mere presence on Earth diminishes our own. I honestly can't thank you enough for putting it into words. After that first book of yours, I had my doubts about you. But I wasn't afraid then to admit I was wrong, and that's how we grow as people.
Kat rejoined the conversation, beaming back and forth at her guests.
And what a story, Lex. You have reached peaks most of us never dream of. Had it all crash in on you. And look at you now. You persevere.
Thank you, Kat. It's true. And now, well, I can't tell you how vindicating it feels to read Clark's book. I was ready to come clean and own up to my actions when he wrote a book about me. But I can't help but wonder, where is Superman while Mr. Kent is trying to hold him accountable?
Hearing this claim, Clark had several objections.
The way I remember it, LexCorp representatives denied the facts my book presented for several years.
That's the thing about employees. They work for me, but they don't speak for me. I am not my company.
Sure, okay, well, I'm not here suggesting Superman needs to be held accountable. This is more about each of us doing some introspection and being willing to improve personally.
Luther closed his eyes, nodding as he listened to Clark speak.
Exactly. This is what I'm talking about.
Luther rallied the audience into applause. Clark found Lex's enthusiasm disorienting and was genuinely relieved when Kat returned the topic to her Van Horn patio furniture. Most of what little time the interview had left was spent with Lex and Kat reaffirming each other's positions. Clark did what he could to mention his book again before the show finally devolved into Lex blowing kisses into the audience and shaking Clark's hand one last time before strutting away. Afterward, back at the Daily Planet, Lois couldn't apologize enough.
Oh my God, Clark, I'm so sorry. I had no idea.
It's all right, Lois. I don't blame you. But I think this has finally convinced me.
Oh? Convinced you of what?
Lex is right. Let's do that interview with Superman.
Lois could not have been more excited, and everything came together far quicker than Clark expected. John Jones was happy to help when asked to stand in again to play the part of Clark Kent. Kara joined in on the production once more, and this time, even Jimmy Olsen got involved in the fun. Clark emphasized the need for Superman to truly be given challenging questions concerning his book. He had several questions of his own to offer, but it was decided that the interview would be most authentic if Superman didn't know in advance what questions would be asked. Clark left the meeting and used the time to take a little break. From high above the atmosphere, he whistled, calling for his dog. Krypto had taken to patrolling the forest that Superman cultivated around the globe, yet was happy to find Clark when called upon. The two of them played in the clouds and took a rest in the Andes Mountains. Clark meant to spend that time thinking of a few more questions he wanted to answer. But instead of asking himself questions, his mind kept wandering specifically to the question, Victor Sage. The six scientists Victor Sage had told Clark about had little in common. For years now, this mysterious man had promised there was a deeper connection between them, but Sage made little sense when directly inquired. No matter what Clark asked, he was only put off to the next day.
tomorrow forever promised answers to all of his questions. As he worried, Crypto could read Clark's body language and licked his face to offer him some very wet reassurance. As promised, when the big day finally came, the details were worked out down to the minutiae of Clark's beard. It was to the point that Jean's appearance as Clark was just different enough from Clark's beard as Superman to minimize their resemblance. Clark hoped the questions his friends planned for him would be challenging. Jean began the interview as Clark Kent.
Thanks for joining me, Superman. I appreciate you being willing to talk to me today.
Clark made sure to respond in his most Superman-sounding voice.
I'm happy to be here, Mr. Kent. You make some strong points in your book, and I'm glad to get this opportunity to talk about it. I read it, and it really struck a nerve. I already didn't know what to do about the lumber mills before your book came out, and I honestly still don't know what to do about them. I'm just glad the workers are forming their unions and can look out for each other.
Jean Jones scratched the back of his neck, capturing Clark's mannerisms precisely.
I'm glad to hear my work has affected you so deeply. You know, while writing it, there were many questions I never got to ask you directly. I'm hoping you might be willing to help me understand some things.
Superman smiled.
Sure thing, Mr. Kent. I would love to.
Jean adjusted the glasses on his face. Clark's face.
Why did you retire?
This was not a question Clark considered out the gate. But in hindsight, this was the exact question Clark should have expected Lois Lane to start with. He paused and took a breath before answering.
Honestly, that's a tender topic. Everything I do as Superman, my only intent is to help. I didn't see how much my efforts to help bothered some people. I never wanted to upset anyone, but it got to the point that everything I did had too high a cost. So I stepped back and removed myself from the equation. It wasn't easy, and it still hurts a bit to think it worked out.
Jean, in the form of Clark, raised a brow.
How does it hurt?
Superman swallowed.
It's not a nice feeling to feel like you're part of the problem.
Jean looked up from his notes.
Do you ever fear that Lex Luthor's right? That you're making things worse?
Clark let out a sigh.
Yeah, of course. I'm afraid of that. I think it's a part of what makes our critics so hard to listen to. Sometimes they speak our worst insecurities out loud. But I try to listen, learn from my mistakes, and do better. Your most recent book has helped give me some perspective. Honestly, I wish I could steer that metaphorical ship you write about. And you're not wrong. The more I try, the more the boat drags itself down. I feel that. It breaks my heart.
Jean paused to give Superman's words time to sink in. After a beat, he went on to the next question.
Even retired, you haven't actually stopped. My previous book inspired you to start planting these forests. But in this last book, I lament that you're stuck replenishing these forests as long as you want to maintain the ecosystem you created. But why not let humanity fix the problem we created ourselves?
Clark sighed again. These were not easy questions after all.
You know, I ask myself that quite a lot. I've retired once now already. I ask myself if this issue is yet another world stage I have to bow out of. I hope it isn't, but I do consider it. Recently, I started asking the countries I support to follow certain labor rights and safety guidelines. I mean it when I tell them I can't support their forests if they can't protect their people. I realize these forests might suffer, but I'm afraid you might be right, and I might just have to mind my own business.
A long silence took hold of the room. Jean, as Clark, gathered himself to respond.
I certainly didn't mean to imply that, Superman. I just hope you're not taken for granted.
Thanks, Mr. Kent. Me too. When the ordeal was complete, Lois applauded Clark.
Bravo, Clark Kent. That was a moment in history. Bravo.
Thanks, Lois, but I think you might be exaggerating a bit.
She scoffed.
Psh, I know what I saw.
Jimmy nodded.
I think she's right, Clark. That was something else. You really know how to be the genuine article when you gotta be.
Clark blushed, though, over the next few weeks, Lois's hope seemed confirmed, despite how much they sounded like hyperbole. The interview with Superman was discussed endlessly. One evening, after everyone had gone to sleep, Clark sat in the kitchen by himself. While watching an analysis for the interview, he was subject to an advertisement for the Justice League International. As usual, it was narrated by Maxwell Lord.
Every day the world is made a little easier, a little smoother, and a little safer, knowing that the Justice League International is looking out for you. Look no further than our all-star team. It's got everything the Justice League is made of. Green Lantern, Blue Beetle, and Booster Gold. Strength, skill, and determination. Stargirl, Stripe, and Tio Morrow. Names synonymous with justice. Heroes you can trust. The Justice League International.
Clark rolled his eyes. These commercials barely had anything to say. He wasn't even sure why the Justice League International advertised, or what they thought they were selling. The ad echoed in Clark's head, looping in his mind until it dawned on him that Thomas Morrow's name was a pun. Tio Morrow. Clark spoke his name out loud. Tomorrow. Hearing this word from his own mouth, the dots began connecting, and it all came together. As promised, everything made sense tomorrow. T.O. Morrow. While pondering Victor Sage's mystery, it had never dawned on Clark to look for any relation to the now-famous futurist working with the Justice League International. Sure enough, it didn't take much scratching to dig up the first connection. Of the two roboticists from Sage's first note, Magnus and Calder, Will Magnus had directly studied under T.O. Morrow when Morrow still went by the name of Tovek Mora. This was no coincidence. Clark finally broke down and called the number on the card given to him. As the phone rang, he found himself pacing. The question answered.
Oh, now you call.
I believe I figured out your clues.
Isn't that convenient?
Excuse me?
I saw your little media parade. Luther's one thing, but I can't believe I didn't see this coming.
See what?
I saw that. Whatever it was you did with Superman. You must take me for a fool.
I did an interview. That's what reporters do.
Oh, sure, buddy. What even was that?
It was just an interview.
I saw what I saw. What are you two? Brothers?
What? No.
I don't need your help. Whatever you are. Don't call this number again. I'll just change it anyway.
Victor Sage hung up the phone. Clark slowly sat down in the empty kitchen. It seemed the Justice League International had been infiltrated. Clark knew he had to do something about it. Tomorrow. Thank you for listening. I'm Isaac Bluefoot. Book 2 of Superman Son of El was written and independently produced by myself. I love telling this story and sharing it with you. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey. It really means a lot to me. This is a commercial-free show, but if you feel compelled to make sure I keep going, you can become a patron at sonofelpodcast.com/support. Thank you to all of my patrons. Your little bit of support makes a huge difference, especially in helping me believe in myself. Another way to bolster my confidence is by leaving comments and reviews. Wherever you spend your time on the internet, I can't be sure I'll see them all, but I love to discover one out in the wild. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This story was inspired by the Superman and DC comics and characters originally created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, with additional contributions by Jim Mooney, Steve Ditko, Ross Andrew, Robert Caniger, Arnold Drake, Bob Haney, Bruno Premiani, Len Wayne, Bernie Wrightson, John Byrne, Bill Finger, Bob Kane, Mike W. Barr, Grant Morrison, Andy Kubert, Joseph Samuelson, Joe Serta, Dick Sprang, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Ordway, Otto Binder, Al Plastino, Kurt Swan, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatisse, Kevin McGuire, John Broom, Gil Kane, Gary Friedrich, Dan Jurgens, Hal Sherman, Jeff Johns, Lee Motor, Gardner Fox, and Carmine Infantino. Music in this episode was made by Blue Dot Sessions, Chris Zabriskie, Crowender, Anatech, Blue Dot Sessions, Tab and Anatech, Axel Tree, Kai Engel, Jazar, Tortue Supersonic, Poddington Bear, Plurabelle, Scott Holmes, and Helizna CC0. See the episode notes for details, and be sure to listen to the next episode, Chapter 18, Below the Surface.